Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do people go hungry in a world capable of producing enough food for everyone? Despite old fears that the Earth would someday contain more humans than it could feed, the rate of food production continues to rise faster than the rate of population growth. Yet something is clearly amiss, because even as we produce more calories per capita every year, hunger rates have begun to rise again after years in decline. So what's to be done, and will a solution require redefining the problem itself? Frederick Kaufman is here to talk about it. He is professor of journalism at City University of New York, whose book, A Short History of the American Stomach, is out now in paperback. He is also a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine, which published his article, Let Them Eat Cash, Can Bill Gates Turn Hunger into Profit, in its June issue. Frederick, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So the article makes perfectly clear that the problem in 2009 is not about the inability to produce sufficient food. So where is the disconnect between food and hungry people?
Yeah, that is precisely the question. There is plenty of food, so why aren't hungry people getting it? And I had no idea why. I went to Rome to the big once-every-five-year meeting of the Food and Agriculture Organization to investigate this and to figure out why, when we produce more food than ever, and in fact more money is being spent than ever before on food relief, why more people in real numbers than ever are hungry. I mean, I remember in the 1970s when we started hearing in America about starving children in Bangladesh and Biafra. This became a big thing in American consciousness. Oh, my Lord, there are hungry people out there in the world, and we have to somehow feed them. Well, that's been lost, and we no longer seem to feel that that's number one on our agenda or number one on the world agenda. Climate change and nuclear energy, this sort of thing, have taken over. Yet, we are almost at a billion hungry people in the world. Now, why is that? And I discovered a lot of it has to do with the money. Money issues as opposed to food issues.
And what is the historic relationship? And you have some interesting research in the article about thousands of years ago, the historic relationship between money and hunger.
Well, there have been many anthropological theories dating back to mostly the radical anthropologists from the 1960s, the idea being that in primitive economies, in Stone Age economies, that you have people who are working less than we work today, who are sleeping more, who are hanging out and doing nothing a lot more of the time, and are eating better, who are never hungry. And the idea is that somehow, as civilization progresses, in fact, more and more hunger starts to exist. And as Stone Age economies turn into cash economies, that somehow this has a negative effect on the net number of people who are getting enough to eat. And in fact, that was part of the investigation I did with the Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen, who teaches at Harvard and at Cambridge. And I went to visit him. He won the Nobel in 1998, and he has a whole different theory of hunger, which has very little to do with food and a lot to do with money, the idea being that food is an entitlement, and that either you can afford this entitlement or you cannot afford this entitlement. And he is this incredible economist who really crunched all these numbers from the great Irish famine of the 1840s and the Bengal famine of 1943 and the famines in Ethiopia. And what he discovered is that often in years of famine, these are actually years of peak food availability, and that somehow, even in the midst of famine, you have provinces in Ethiopia or parts of Ireland where the food is actually leaving. It's going someplace else. So the idea to solve famine actually is pretty simple. You need some sort of government intervention. You need immediate food relief programs. You need immediate employment programs. You need immediate money that's given to people. The funny thing is that these, for some reason, are very hard to put together and that our focus has gone to other areas. So, for instance, one of the big issues in stopping world hunger and stopping famine is political. Famines don't very often happen in democracies. Famines hardly ever happen where there is a free press, because the rulers do not, of course, like to see photographs of starving children on the front page of their newspapers. Famine happens when rulers are alienated from the people they rule, and therefore famines hardly ever happen in representative democracies.
Hmm. Now, the actual numbers of hungry people have begun to climb again. What do experts think is going on? Is it simply a factor that we have sort of lost our focus on the problem?
Well, actually, that's part of it. We lost our focus on the problem, and we stopped investing as much as we might in agricultural development and agricultural program and agricultural aid throughout the 1980s and early 1990s. But there's also something else going on, something that was really disturbing to me, which is that you had in 2007, as we all know, there was a big subprime crisis and a huge crisis in stock markets across the world. A lot of very large investors, a hedge against huge losses, started putting their money into commodities like gold, like precious metals, like energy and oil, and, of course, food is one of the major commodities. And what you saw in 2008, which was the year of the great world food crisis, is a spike in food costs. You saw a spike in cooking oil. You saw a spike in inputs for food, such as fertilizer, of almost 400%. And what happened during that period is that as these commodities went higher and higher and higher through 2008, many people in the world were literally no longer able to afford their daily bread. Like here in the United States, maybe we're spending 10 to 15% of our paycheck on food, maybe less. Well, if you're spending in other parts of the world 80 or 90% of your daily paycheck on food, if that food doubles in price, you are not going to eat. And that is what happened in 2008, and that is what sparked riots in 29 countries around the world in 2008. That is what sparked hunger riots in Milwaukee, in this country, in the summer of 2008. And that's all. That's partially why I went to Rome, to try and figure out what was going on, who was trying to solve this problem, and why we were seeing utter failure.
Were people in Rome talking a lot about biofuel production?
Yeah, that was one of the elements of what I call the famine narrative. There are many, many elements. There is drought, there is climate change, there is war, there is crop failure, there are caterpillar plagues, but also there's biofuel production. And of course, this did put a lot of pressure. It put a lot of pressure on land which is being cultivated for human crops. So in other words, what you have are requirements that a certain amount of acreage goes to biofuel production. And this has had a very strong effect on pushing up the prices of corn, for instance, in this country. When I was in Rome, for instance, the president of Brazil came down very hard on the United States on our biofuel programs, and basically saying that we were using more energy to create these biofuels than they would ultimately create. And he was kind of proposing that people should look to Brazil for their technology of using sugarcane as opposed to corn ethanol production. I believe we're using not just corn but other crops for ethanol production in this country.
Now, one of the people that you met with was the executive director of the World Food Program. This woman named Josette Sheeran. Can you talk about her a little bit?
Josette Sheeran is a very interesting character, and you know, before I go into what I'm going to say about Josette Sheeran and the World Food Program, I just want to preface this by saying, and Bill Gates too, which is that there are a lot of people out there who are trying to end world hunger, and they are really smart people, and I think in many ways very, very good people, and they should be commended. However, I also believe that a lot of these people, among them Josette Sheeran, are going about this the wrong way. She is a very interesting character. One of the things that I bring up in the article is that she was a member of the Unification Church for a long time, the very right-wing organization. And
this is the Reverend Sung Young Moon.
Yeah, the Reverend Sung Young Moon. And she ended up being the managing editor of the Washington Times, which is the newspaper that's the right-wing newspaper that's owned by the Unification Church. And after she was the managing editor there, she left the church. She converted to Episcopalianism. She joined the administration of George W. Bush. And then she left and decided she wanted to feed the hungry, and now she's the president of the World Food Program. Now, what is the World Food Program? It is the largest humanitarian organization in the world. It has a budget this past year of $6 billion. And I spoke to her a couple of times about what their plans are and how they're going about their ideas of ending world hunger. And to a great extent, this is the essence of my article, is their most recent plans with the help of Bill Gates and the Bill Gates Foundation, the Howard Buffett Foundation, and some other governmental organizations. They're working in concert with in a program called Purchase for Progress. And we can talk about that a little bit if you like. And to me, that seems to be the crux of their efforts at this point. And it seems to me rather wrongheaded.
Yeah, it boils down in some ways to let the markets solve the problem.
Yeah, what you have here is a real free market ideology kind of gone berserk, it seems to me. I think a lot of these people forget that one of the reasons why American agriculture works as efficiently as it does, I mean, this of course, is some people are going to argue different parts of almost anything I'm going to say here, but look, American agriculture works well by certain standards, feeding a lot of people with not many people working these farms. One of the reasons it works so well is because of all of the subsidies, of all the government help. It is not a free market in American agriculture, and yet they're taking this kind of knee-jerk belief in free market ideology and saying, okay, now we're going to use this idea and kind of throw it as a blanket over developing nations in Africa and in South America, and that somehow this idea of the free market, which never really existed here, is going to exist there, and particularly through the idea of commodity exchanges. The idea of Purchase for Progress, one of the many ideas, because of course it's a rather complicated program, one of the many ideas is creating commodity exchanges in countries like Tanzania, in Uganda, where one has existed now for a year or two, and in Rwanda, and allowing small farmers to actually trade their crops on international commodity exchanges. The idea is that these commodity exchanges are going to help stabilize prices, that they are going to help these farmers make more money. It just seems to me, the more I looked at this, that this is a farce, that this is outrageous, that these smallholder farmers who are farming on less than 5 acres are going to overnight become commodity traders and on their cell phones and arbitraging their goods. And it seemed to me absurd, and so I tried to take a look at this and see, you know, what is really going on here.
Yeah, and one of the things that this program would do would be to encourage these farmers, especially those who are producing things like grain that can last for some time, to sort of hold on to what they have produced until the price is something that they want.
Yeah, this is one of the problems with farmers, particularly smallholder farmers in Africa. When I say smallholders, once again, less than 5 acres, we have about 450 million of these smallholder farmers on Earth. They and their families probably comprise about a third of the world's population. And a lot of these people go hungry, and a lot of these people find themselves in all sorts of binds throughout the year, in the sense that when they have their crop, when they're trying to sell their crop, they find that a lot of other of their cohorts are also selling their crops. Therefore, the dealers can buy it for less, of course. And so they get into a bind where they're actually selling low, and then later in the year, when they actually are hungry, have to buy their food back at a much higher price. And so year after year, they're losing money and being driven off the land. And I have to commend the World Food Program, actually, for seeing this as a problem and trying to solve it by saying, okay, what you'll do is, instead of actually selling your crops directly to a dealer, what you can do is warehouse your crops, get a warehouse receipt, and once you have that warehouse receipt, you can use it to trade, to hoard your crops, to hedge, to use it to get insurance, a whole number of financial constructs that you can use this receipt for, and hopefully you'll be able to make more money in the long run from it.
My guest is Frederick Kaufman. He's a contributing editor to Harper's, which has just published his article, Let Them Eat Cash, Can Bill Gates Turn Hunger into Profit, in its June issue. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frederick Kaufman. His book, A Short History of the American Stomach, is out now in paperback. He's also a contributing editor for Harper's, which has just published his article, Let Them Eat Cash: Can Bill Gates Turn Hunger into Profit? If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Frederick, we can look at this Purchase for Progress program and think, well, it might at some point be better for farmers and allow them to make more money. But, of course, it doesn't really take into account what happens to the rest of the market when you have this third of the world's population behaving in these ways.
Yeah, that's one of the big issues, thank you, Chris, is the whole issue of what do commodity markets do anyway to these markets. And the theory, of course, is that arbitrage strategies and commodity markets, the trade in futures, these are all very murky concepts, but the theory behind them is that they're going to make these prices real and natural and stabilize them. But of course, as we know, as we can see from what just happened in this country in the recent financial crisis, really what you're seeing is wild speculation in these markets and wild price fluctuations. Markets go, they spike all the way up, and then they completely bottom out. And this is going to be, you know, for obvious reasons, a very difficult situation for these farmers to deal with. Now, who wins when you put in place a commodity market? And I was thinking, why is a World Food Program, what is their stake in putting together commodity markets in Africa? So I took a look at how these markets work, and what I realized is that every day all the buying and selling on a commodity market has to be covered, and that's called the margin. There's a margin every day that has to be covered by the bank. So what you have are banks who are holding tremendous amounts of money. That guarantees the workings of a commodity market. Now, of course, when you have bankers in Rwanda and bankers in Tanzania and bankers in Uganda, these are, of course, people who have a lot of power and who are very close to the people, the presidents, the people who are running the joint. And, of course, when you put in a commodity market, what you're doing is you're driving a tremendous amount of capital into their hands. And, of course, once they're holding these huge margin accounts, as we all know, you can simply leverage that into more and more money. And so it seemed to me that there was something else going on here, that kind of under the guise of solving world hunger, what they were actually doing is really supporting politics and economies in a much different way, in much more of the trickle-down way, supporting the rich who are already rich and making sure they're going to stay rich and get richer.
So there's no arm of this program, at least as it exists now in concept, that would deal with the possibility of corruption at the government level?
No. Well, the program, the World Food Program, is not, is strictly apolitical. I mean, if you talk to them, they will tell you, no, we are not interested in politics. No, we are not involved in politics. And on the face of that, of course, it's true. What's happening is that there is an old style of international food relief. The World Food Program starts their business in 1962. It was conceptualized by the Eisenhower administration, and the idea was to take excess food from this country, from America, and to put it on American ships and to send it overseas and then to distribute it in other parts of the world that needed it most. Now, this was an idea that has come under tremendous criticism, the idea being that, well, all we're doing really, instead of helping the world, is we're subsidizing American farmers and we're paying for American shipping. But in fact, very recently, this has become too expensive. There are not the surpluses, and it's just too expensive to ship huge, you know, tonnage of grain all across the globe. So what the World Food Program did is they started buying excess grain much closer to the sources of the famine. Therefore, they spent millions of dollars buying food in Uganda last year. They spent millions of dollars buying food in Rwanda last year from large grain dealers there. Of course, this makes the governments of these countries very willing to cooperate in any program the World Food Program might want them to cooperate with.
My guest is Frederick Kaufman. His new article in Harper's is called Let Them Eat Cash: Can Bill Gates Turn Hunger into Profit? Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and we'll go first to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hello. What a wonderful program. I wonder if I could kind of shift the focus a little bit just primarily on how America helps battle this problem. It seems to me that in terms of more traditional foreign policy, we tend to be most aggressive with countries that have something that we need, a resource or what have you. That's where we're the most aggressive and not just kind of idly sitting by and posing, if you will. I wonder if the author sees any type of connection in the same way with how we aid those who are hungry in the world. I'm speaking maybe not knowing very much about it, but it seems to me that we really tend to help those who have something that we want or that we need or that we can make money off of the most. Is there a correlation there, or am I just kind of fishing in murky water? Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Frederick, what do you think?
I think it's a very insightful question, and I think we do have to consider what is it that American foreign policy has that has a stake in Uganda or in Rwanda or in Tanzania or in Guatemala or in a lot of these developing nations, but particularly in Africa. So let's just look. I really focus in the article on these African nations, and particularly Uganda. Now, Uganda actually is an extremely strategic position geopolitically. If you just look at its neighbors, it's right near the Democratic Republic of Congo, and of course, to the north, you have Sudan, and you have Somalia. You have all of these countries which are really important in American foreign policy surrounding Uganda. Therefore, I think it's in American interest to make sure that Uganda is solidly capitalist, is solidly focused on the kinds of interests that Americans are perceived to have throughout the world, and to put it solidly in our hand. I think there's the perception that if Uganda has a solid financial and capitalist backing, that it will not become a breeding ground for, let's say, international terrorism, that it will not become a breeding ground for, let's say, international communism. And so I do think that there is a kind of underneath the iceberg, there are elements of this kind of ulterior motivation. Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about that.
Do you think it's a valid assumption that if we let these places starve, they're at a greater danger for growing into entities that do directly threaten our interests?
Well, I think the whole assumption of if we let these places starve, I mean, to a certain extent, there's a chauvinism in the question, which is somehow that we are the ones, just as we are the police keepers of the world, that we are the ones who will let countries starve or give countries food. That's not necessarily the case. And if you look at a lot of these countries, you'll see that sure, there are famines and there are interventions that we can make. But for the most part, there are smart people in these countries. There are smart economists in these countries and smart agriculturalists in these countries. They know what to do there to make it happen. They know what they need. So when I was in Rome, for instance, what I heard again and again and again is from African countries basically saying, you know what, leave us alone. We really don't need your intervention at this level. We do not need your financialization at this level. We can do it ourselves. By the same token, we'll also hear from other countries, please invest in us. Please give us money. Please give us Western-style capitalism. We want the money. And so you have twin messages coming out of this, and it's sometimes it's unclear and it's murky precisely who's talking and for what reason.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting program for those of us who are interested to see the suffering of other people. Yeah, my question to you, I guess, is how do we reconcile this idea of some leaders in African countries that are more interested in buying arms, weapons, instead of encouraging their people in agriculture, feeding their people? And you also see it from developed countries where they are encouraging these leaders to buy arms. So how do you reconcile the idea that we're going to eliminate hunger in the world when they are taking this as a priority?
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
I think, once again, that's really an excellent question. I think that if you look at the money, for instance, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, which is the part of the arm of the UN, which is given the responsibility of dealing with world hunger, Jacques Diouf is the head of the FAO. And he believes that for $30 billion a year, that his organization can effectively end world hunger. Now, you know, on a certain level, $30 billion is a lot of money. But if you look at the world arms trade, or if you look at the numbers that are, you know, flying around this country in terms of stimulus packages, $30 billion is not that much money. And so the arms trade, the world arms trade, completely dwarfs the world food aid budgets. And that is another very disturbing question, which is that most Americans, you know, we are comfortable in this country for the most part. That's not to say there isn't hunger in this country, but for the most part, our supermarkets are full. We do not realize that almost a quarter of the world has food insecurity. They're either in calories or missing meals. Most of these people who are suffering are, of course, women and children, not men, but women and children. And this is a big crisis, and ultimately it is very solvable. This is what all the people I spoke to, all the hungercrats, all the economists told me. This problem is very solvable. And it's a real shame, I think, for the entire world. I think it's a shameful fact that we're looking at almost a billion starving people, and that bottom billion could easily become the bottom 2 billion if the worldwide recession continues and it's on its path.
Well, it's interesting when we make the comparison between arms spending and hunger spending, because as you touch on in the piece, there is also a relationship between violence and unrest and hunger within any particular society.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, these are the issues of poverty, and part of the whole issue of my story is that it is not lack of food which is driving the violence and is driving the unrest. It is lack of money. And in fact, the reason people don't have enough to eat, the reason people are starving, is not because there's not enough food for them. It's because they don't have the money to buy the food.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with William. Hey, William.
Hello. I found some very interesting articles recently on this topic. The June Scientific American has an article stating that the world supply of phosphorus or phosphates used in fertilizer will likely be used up within this century, that the U.S. has about 19% of the phosphate reserves and Morocco has 40%. And that's just enough phosphate for a few more decades of agricultural use. And they say phosphorus, a looming famine crisis. And every living organism from a bacteria to an elephant uses phosphorus as its energy currency. Our food is converted into the phosphate ions. And I also read in, yesterday's Wall Street Journal that the battery company BYD is the leader in making batteries for cars.
Right. Well, let's take. I appreciate your call, William. Let's start with the phosphate issue, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that, Frederick.
Yeah. First of all, I agree with this caller. I thought it was a very interesting article in last month's Scientific American. And it was written by Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute, who's really a brilliant thinker, and is looking at world hunger from all sorts of angles that a lot of other people aren't. He's one of these guys who's to use the old cliche, is thinking outside the box. He's not in the old standard form of international food aid. And one of the issues in the article that he's pointing out is that. World famine and world hunger are also huge world technology issues and world ecology issues. And the phosphate issue is, of course, you know, really important. We need the phosphates. Now, what is he proposing? One of the things Lester Brown proposes, and I think he's completely right here, is we need more money spent on research and development for future fertilizers and for more sustainable agricultural techniques. So that we do not have to do the same old techniques that we've been using really since the advent of the Green Revolution in the 1970s, which was when a lot of money was spent to use artificial fertilizers and new irrigation techniques to bring impoverished countries up to speed with their food production. That Green Revolution worked very well for a number of years, but lately it's proven not to be sustainable in terms of water availability and in terms of, you know, what that land, the nutrients in the soil. And therefore, there's a lot of research that's needed in this area. And part of the whole issue with, let's say, international food relief organizations is, once again, perhaps they are not focusing enough on research and development of agricultural technology. This is a real area in which we've fallen down. The entire world has fallen down the past 10, 15 years. We've taken it for granted, and now we're going to pay the price.
Unrelated to the piece we're talking about today, Frederick, you've done some interesting writing recently about genetically modified crops, which proponents argue could solve a lot more problems by increasing yields and getting rid of disease and maybe reducing the need for artificial fertilizers. Have you come to any conclusion about whether we are not sufficiently exploiting the ability to change the foods that we eat and grow?
Chris, now you're getting really controversial here. You know, the genetically modified crops debate is a real monkey wrench into the hunger debate, and it's a very, very difficult question. What you find are a lot of people who are very liberal thinkers on this issue kind of stop genetically modified organisms, and they say, okay, no way, this is not going to happen. We are not going to have Frankenfood feed the world, and we're just going to be causing more problems than ever. A lot of the academics, on the other hand, are saying quite the opposite, which is that food technology and the growth of food technology is what we need, to feed the world. And I think there are a couple of issues here at stake. I think one of the main issues that people aren't talking about enough in terms of genetically modified organisms is copyright law. I think people see Monsanto and Bayer and these large purveyors of genetically modified seeds as very bad players, and I would agree with them. And why are they bad players? Because they're taking a seed. If you think of a seed as kind of like a stack in terms of its DNA of 1,000 pennies, they're putting one penny on the top, and they're saying the whole thing's mine. That's not right. That's not sustainable. That's not going to go forward.
Frederick Kaufman is my guest. We're talking about his article in the new Harper's Magazine, Let Them Eat Cash, Can Bill Gates Turn Hunger into Profit? You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Frederick Kaufman is my guest. He's professor of journalism at City University of New York. His book, A Short History of the American Stomach, is out now in paperback. We're talking today about his newest article for Harper's Magazine, for which he is contributing editor. It's called Let Them Eat Cash, Can Bill Gates Turn Hunger into Profit? If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us, and we will go next to the phones and speak with Scott in Dallas. Hello, Scott.
Hi. My question for your caller is based on the issue of population control or family planning and how that relates to global hunger. Because, I mean, it's mentioned in the latest National Geographic article on the topic, but so often it seems like a real elephant in the living room that people are afraid to address when talking about this issue. And I'm just wondering what your guest has to say about that and the role that it plays. Considering that it's had such an impact on mitigating the problem in places, you know, from Brazil to Thailand to China and elsewhere.
Thanks for
Iran,
your call.
Et cetera.
What do you think, Frederick?
Well, I think he's absolutely on the money there, which is that one of the key indicators of a country where there is not a hunger problem is the level of education of women. The more educated women are in a particular country, the less hunger there is, the less famine there is. And that's because when women more educated they are, the more power they tend to be able to wield over their own bodies, and therefore you'll find that these women are not having 10 or 12 children. They're not allowing their bodies to be used like that, and therefore what you're seeing is less hunger. Now, of course, this is a difficult and controversial point in and of itself, because the fact of the matter is that the problem with feeding the world is not that there are too many people. in the sense that it's not as though, oh my God, they're having so many children, they should be stopped, and hunger is a corrective. That's the old theory of Thomas Malthus from the 18th century, and it's been proved wrong. His idea was that population growth is always going to exceed agricultural growth, and therefore famine and hunger is some sort of a corrective. That's not true. We have enough food to feed the world, to feed the 6.5 billion people on Earth. We have enough food right now. We have the capacity to feed about 9 billion people on Earth. And so although the caller makes the right point, which is that women in cultures, if they are better educated, there is going to be less hunger from family to family to family, the large point, I don't think, is birth control, although I'm all in favor of it. I think the larger point is, why can't we feed the number of people on Earth today when, in fact, we have full capacity? I'd like to revisit also what we were talking earlier about genetically modified sure. organisms. I guess because I'm a masochist at a certain point. So the more I talk about this, and no matter what you say about this, you're going to be offending somebody. Which is that there has been a real binary opposition, really, for the past 10 or 15 years with genetically modified high tech on one side, and organic, sustainable on the other. And I think that as we move into the future, I think that this binary opposition is not going to stand. I'm thinking about a lot of the research that's going on at UC Davis right now in which we're using organic farms in conjunction with certain genetically modified strains of rice. So, for instance, Professor Pamela Ronald over there, who's married to the head of their organic farming program, she is a genetic engineer herself and has come up with a strain of rice which is it has full defense against flooding. It will not die in a flood. And what she's shown is that, in fact, with this addition of a gene, this rice is able to withstand flooding. Now, this is a great thing. This is, you know, conceivably a great thing, and is going to increase yield and, in fact, stop people from starving. Now, what I really am against is telling other people what to do and to make decisions for them. I think that countries are out there can make their own decisions about whether they want this rice or not and what they want to do with it. And I also think we should not be telling scientists what they should or should not be studying. And, of course, this is a separate issue from the whole industry question. As I said earlier, I think this is outrageous what Monsanto and the other large agribusinesses are insisting upon in terms of legal royalty payments and owning these seeds, which I think is a complete shame.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Beefy in Dallas. Hi, Beefy.
You had stated earlier that there was a correlation between stability and the lack of hunger in a country. And my question was, why does the United Nations not take a more aggressive approach towards protecting citizens of an individual country as opposed to respecting or honoring the governments that may be against the people? For example, I would use Zimbabwe as an example of a country where the people were actually hungry, but for diplomatic reasons, the United Nations was not as aggressive with the President Mugabe as it could have been. People ended up suffering of cholera and malnutrition.
Frederick, what do you think about that? Is it an issue of protocol and diplomacy, or does the UN lack the resources necessary?
Well, I think, you know, once again, I think the caller is right, which is that the UN is not taking as aggressive a stance as it should politically and in terms of hunger. Certainly, they are not being as aggressive as they could be. Now, however, we have to realize that we cannot simply rely on the UN to, once again, be the world's policeman and to tell people what to do. When I was talking to Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winner in economics in 1998, basically what he was telling me is that no one organization can do this alone. Although there are simple ways to end world hunger, and it is an eminently solvable problem, what you need is the cooperation of governments, of non-governmental organizations, of people working together, of farmers working together, with bankers, with technology. If we all get this together with the press and with representative democracy, guess what? We can end it. We can end world hunger. I think it's kind of a false paradigm to say it's the UN's fault. The UN should have done X, Y, and Z. The UN is just the UN. I mean, it's a. I think it has a, you know, obviously it has the great idea,
But I don't know if it, if it's ultimately able to enact and execute all these elements we'd like them to.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Jose in Garland. Hi, Jose.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good, good. I just want to say that, I mean, really, the United States is not going poor, and world hunger can be stopped very simple. I mean, there's thousands of people that can go back to farming and grow food. And I got some good ideas for the government to stop giving so much money away to people that kind of want to sit around and don't do nothing. I mean,
just give us one or two of them.
Like, for example, if, I mean, like, people that get food stamps and all this and all that, I mean, there's a lot of people that can still work. Instead of giving them food stamps or stuff like that, we can, I mean, create farms where they can go and help create more food for their people, and that way they can take the food they need for that day back to their family.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Of course, I think Jose is talking a lot about domestic hunger and food insecurity, but there is certainly a relationship between the problem here in this country and the problem of famine and starvation elsewhere in the world.
There's no question. And one of the big issues in world hunger, not just in this country, but in global hunger, is getting small farmers, keeping them on the farm. In other words, Jose is absolutely right, which is that you have people who can work and who would like to be small farmers, and they should be encouraged to be small farmers. Now, what is the solution? Is the solution to global hunger an entire world of small farmers? I'm not so sure. I mean, you look at a country like China, which having gone through a terrible period in the late 1950s and the early 1960s of famine, where you have 20 million people dying, is now able to feed its people with a much smaller percentage of farmers. It's an incredible miracle, right? They've done a great job. And so what we're looking at is a mixture here going forward, I believe, of small farmers, of small plots, and also larger farmers and larger agribusiness. I do think that it is inevitable that there's going to be a place in the future for large farms. There's no question that this is going to be necessary to feed the world going forward.
How different is the problem of hunger for urban versus rural residents in the developing world?
That's a fascinating question. I mean, one of the big issues, of course, is just following up with the previous question, is that what you're seeing is a lot of rural poverty, people who can no longer afford to be farmers, who were farmers and who are living rurally, who are then coming into the cities and becoming the urban poor. And of course, the issues are very different for both. And what you'll find is that often the rural populations, because they're out in the country, will sometimes have more access to food than the urban poor. The other thing that's really interesting, and Raj Patel in his book Stuffed and Starved really showed this very clearly, which is that stuffed and starved, you have people who are going without food, and then you have people who are in urban environments who are making money, but not enough money, and buying very cheap food which is not giving them the proper nutrition, but is maybe giving them a lot of fat and is maybe giving them a lot of sugar. And so what you're seeing is increasingly urban populations of urban poor that are obese and are fat. They are being starved in a completely other way. They're being starved of nutrients, and they're being made sick by the same quotient. So it's a very fascinating question about how hunger plays across rural and urban populations.
Let's go next to Fort Worth, where we'll speak with Terry. Hello, Terry.
Hi. I'll try and be concise and get this out. You expressed earlier the opinion that the programs that are set up by Bill Gates and the World Organization might kind of be a shadow mechanism, that it really is to funnel money through the banking system. And I sympathize with that point of view, but assuming that's the case, can you look at that from the other side, and could that be a mechanism that will in fact sustain itself because of the big money involved, and there might be ancillary benefits to the real problem derived from that, whereas if it was a more direct system involving the farmers and the poor, the system might not be able to continue and sustain itself adequately.
Yeah, I mean, that you're right at the core of the issue right there, which is that Bill Gates, this grant that he's giving for Purchase for Progress, I believe it's $67 million, and he believes that with that money and with this startup money, they are going to create sustainable markets for food and for agriculture in these developing countries. And as I said earlier, I commend the idea. I think it's a great idea. I am just not so sure that on the ground running, it's actually going to play out. I was just reading today about the history of commodity markets in America, and this only happens in this country after, you know, you get these markets in the Chicago Board of Trade in the mid-19th century, and it's over years and years and decades of argument and legal cases that this system comes into being, this incredible system, and it works in this country to a certain extent. You have to realize that Harwood Schaefer, in his newsletter from the University of Tennessee, often cites the fact that 94% of the farmers in this country aren't making it, despite this incredible market mechanism. I am just not so sure that those markets, and those commodity markets in particular, with all their hedging and arbitrage and indexing, is going to be the answer to this issue.
Do you think Gates just doesn't get it?
Gates is a money man. You know, Gates is a very successful monopolist. I think he knows what works for him, and I think in his heart of hearts, he's trying to do what's best. So, yes, I'd have to agree with you. He doesn't get it. Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that a system like this might be successful as a component to a larger effort that also contains different approaches?
Well, I think that's possible, and I don't want to be too unfair to Purchase for Profit, which is that there are a lot of elements in this program, in the World Food Program. What they're trying to do is they're trying to, you know, build warehouses so people can, you know, put their crops someplace safe. They're trying to partner with other agencies and other NGOs so that they can build infrastructure and that they can build roads, this sort of thing. And so it is, to the extent that they can make it, a holistic approach. However, it is just $67 million ultimately is not a lot of money. And so they're trying to get something in place. They're trying to jumpstart these things. And I'm not so sure that they're really doing this with enough sensitivity to local culture, local environment, and local economy.
If the sort of average American wanted to do something about the problem and spend, say, $100, what sort of organization would you recommend they funnel that money to?
Well, you know, that is such an interesting question. What do you do? You know, what do you do with your money? How do you want? You know, if you want to end world hunger, how do you do that? Where should you send your money? Look, Oxfam is a great place to send your money. I mean, they're doing a lot of good stuff. I think that ActionAid International is really trying to solve this problem from another perspective, from the bottom up. I think those are two very good organizations if you feel like contributing. And contributing money is the way to go. I mean, that has a huge effect.
Frederick Kaufman is professor of journalism at City University of New York. His book, A Short History of the American Stomach, is out in paperback. His article in Harper's Magazine is called Let Them Eat Cash. Can Bill Gates Turn Hunger into Profit? It's in the June issue. Frederick, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.